Arroyo. Major Bruja, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Lee, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major Heather Bruja, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, we represent Senior Airman Monica Arroyo, the appellant in this case. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I would like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Air Force Court erred in its sentence severity review when it considered the benefit enjoyed by Senior Airman Arroyo when the government dismissed specifications. Because Airman Arroyo is to be sentenced only for the offense she was convicted of, and that error prejudiced her. Turning first to the error, Rule for Court-Martial 1001 does not permit in any place that dismissed specifications should be considered when adjudging a sentence, nor did the military judge have evidence of the dismissed specifications in its sentence hearing. Further, RCM 1001B3A, in its discussion, explicitly states that accused should only be sentenced for the crime they are convicted of in that court-martial. Further, Article 56, when giving instruction to the military judge on adjudging a sentence, it says for the offense convicted, that is the offense that the judge is to sentence us to provide a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary. In this case, a bad conduct discharge was greater than necessary. And the CCA erred when it considered the dismissed specifications in its sentence severity review. RCM 1002F also mirrors what Article 56 says. We know the Air Force Court considered this weighty benefit that Airman Arroyo had in this dismissed specifications for several reasons.
Can I stop you for a moment and tease this out a little bit? Now, much of your focus in your brief is on the violation of presumption of innocence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your point is that the CCA must have considered the fact that the accused actually engaged in this misconduct that was in the dismissed charges and factored it in.
Yes.
Correct? Let's say that this court were to disagree with you on that minor point and credit the statements of the CCA in its opinion, where essentially it says simply that they're looking at this in the context of the punitive exposure that your client could have faced here. Can you still prevail?
Yes, Your Honor, because when it considered the dismissed specifications, it gave weight to that in finding the BCD appropriate. Essentially, it let the dismissed specifications aggravate Airman Arroyo's case, which was inappropriate. We know that because they specifically stated in their opinion that the benefit not only reduced her criminal exposure, but also ensured that she would not be exposed to additional significant collateral consequences. And it goes on. We know the Air Force Court gave great weight to this benefit that Airman Arroyo received because of its placement in the analysis section. These aren't just restating facts. There's a fact section. This is in the analysis. It's in the middle of the analysis. It's a third of the analysis. And we see the next sentence following the paragraph where they go greatly into this benefit. The Air Force Court said, we also find it significant, and it goes on, showing that they found this weighty benefit where Airman Arroyo escaped these criminal exposure and these weighty other significant collateral consequences in having the dismissed specifications. It considered that in finding the BCD was appropriate. And had it not considered that, the Air Force Court would not have found that a bad conduct discharge is appropriate because it's simply not.
It's your point that this is a completely extraneous, irrelevant consideration, whether an accused or at this point the appellant when it goes before the CCA has zero dismissed charges or 100 dismissed charges. That is an irrelevant consideration for the CCA to consider in the course of its sentence appropriateness review.
For sentence appropriateness review, yes, Your Honor. This is not like the cases where the appellant argues IAC, and if they if absent the deficient performance, they wouldn't have accepted the plea agreement, like Hannah, Kingsbury, Bradley, Firth. It's also not a case where the appellant is raising multiplicious charges, like Hardy and Campbell, or consideration of resurrection of pleas in Cook when the plea was found to be improvident, or when one party breached the agreement, which did not happen here, and it happened in Smead where the government breached, and another case where the appellant breached. In those cases, it would be appropriate for the Air Force Court to look further into the plea agreement. But just as Jesse said, it depends on what the appellate issue is, on what on the basis of the entire record means. We know that from Bethea, where it stated that legal and factual sufficiency is stuck to what the military judge or the fact finder had, but for sentence appropriateness, the community authority and what he considered in allied papers would be appropriate. All of that was appropriate here. But considering the fact that the Air Force Court used mere allegations to aggravate the sentence that it found appropriate, that's not. And we know also that they spent great weight on that point and consideration because when you look at the dissent, the dissenting judge makes a point, one of the three judges on that panel, to say the fact that she was charged with other crimes is not relevant. The fact that those alleged criminal offenses were dismissed is not relevant.
So what was the government required to do in this case? They're negotiating a plea agreement, and they're talking about sentence, and who's going to do and what each side is going to do. Do they have to think about in their mind if this goes up to the CCA on review, and they don't, if they're not allowed to look at all the benefits that the accused bargained for in their plea agreement, that maybe the sentence that we've all agreed to in the plea agreement is going to be too severe because there's all these benefits that are acceptable to look at for approving the plea agreement purposes but are not acceptable to look at for sentencing? Is that basically creating a trap that an unwary trial counsel may accidentally walk into because they hammer out this plea agreement with the accused, and then it goes up on appeal, and they're like, well, we have to ignore all these benefits that the accused bargained for in the sentence appropriateness review, and now the sentence is too severe.
Your Honor, the government should be considering if they put in sufficient facts in the stipulation of fact in order to justify whatever sentence it is arguing for and whatever at least at the minimum that they are arguing for. And whether other factors involved in the plea agreement can be considered, though that can become an issue, but the government should know that when it comes to sentence severity, Congress mandated a de novo look from the CCA to ensure uniformity, even-handedness, as this Court said in Sothen. There is an independent review. All parties know about this appellate right that the appellant or that the accused at that time has because the appellate's rights advisement is put into evidence. Further, in this case, Your Honor, all parties understood that the bad conduct discharge might not be adjudged. We know that because in paragraph 5 of the plea agreement, JA-192, the BCD was a severable term to this contract or plea agreement. They contemplated it not being approved, and they provided alternatives, that if it wasn't approved and the community authority wanted to initiate a discharge, Airman Arroyo would waive a UOTHC, a term the government would have relayed to have understood. And further, we know that it was a contemplated term because in the community authority himself wanted to disapprove the bad conduct discharge after the court-martial. And that's seen in Airman Arroyo's response to submission of matters. But when it took too long for the deputy SJA to advise the community authority he couldn't disapprove, they'd also lost the opportunity for them to waive the confinement beyond 14 days, which was the minimum term.
So, Counsel, may I ask about the opinion? There's the one paragraph where they mention that the charges were dismissed and the exposure was greatly reduced and so forth. I'm over on JA-22. And then there's the paragraph underneath it where they cite two factors. Number one, that defense counsel argued for a BCD and that appellant agreed with this. Are those proper things to consider?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Hendon, one factor to be considered is that the appellant agreed to a term.
And see, my issue is, in reading the preceding paragraph, is that paragraph saying, what are you complaining about? You got a bunch of charges dismissed, which I think your position would be that's improper. Or is it saying, this is in the context of an agreement was made, defense counsel argued for this, and the appellant accepted it. Because if that previous paragraph is merely setting up the context to say, well, they had an agreement, and then it's the next paragraph where they say, defense counsel argued for the BCD, appellant agreed to it, well, that's not problematic, as you've just said. So my question is, how do we really know what's going on in that previous paragraph? Are they really saying that, what are you complaining about? You got charges dismissed. Or are they merely saying, we're looking at this in the context of an agreement that's been made, and pursuant to that agreement, counsel argued for a BCD, and appellant agreed to it?
Your Honor, I would argue that it's because of the length of the discussion, the details of the discussion, the fact that it takes up a third of the analysis, and that the dissenting judge felt need to specifically say that's not relevant. Neither of those points are relevant. I think we know that they did consider it as weighing it in on the sentence severity. And again, this isn't like some of the other cases where there's a question of a resurrection of pleas or a voluntariness of a plea. That was never in question here. It was simply the Air Force Court needing to do a sentence severity review, which, as other CCAs have said, Williams and even Marine Court, it is not a CCA's job to surrender their congressional duty to decide if a sentence is appropriate to the parties or to the military judge. It is a de novo review. So while it can be considered that Airman Arroyo agreed to a BCD and argued for it, that is not an end-all be-all. They also have to do an independent look at the evidence. What the evidence had here, Your Honors, is a leg touch. A group of friends got together on New Year's Eve. They were eating together. They were drinking together. They were playing games together. Shortly before New Year's, Airman Arroyo sat down on the couch next to with other people around and touched leg. Those are the facts.
So what if in the plea agreement they reference the fact that, I'm talking not about in this particular case, but going forward, in future cases, if an accused were to say specifically that the accused recognizes that it could be, the dismissed charges could have been deemed meritorious, and that was part of the consideration for this specific plea and the specific sentence, could a CCA then consider it?
I think there are lots of rights that appellants can knowingly and voluntarily waive and give up. And so potentially, like in the unreasonable multiplication charges cases like Hardy and Campbell, where they knowingly waive certain points, that could be possible, Your Honor. But that's not what happened here.
No, I know that's not what happened here. But building on the question that was posed by Judge Hardy, it does seem a little strange to put blinders on the CCA about what occurred here, but it should also seems as if there is a safety valve of making sure the trial counsel does his or her job to properly tee this up for consideration at the CCA level.
Yes, Your Honor. As the dissent stated, the trial counsel could have put in sufficient facts in the stipulation of facts necessary to justify a bad conduct discharge, or the military judge could have asked questions sufficient during the care inquiry, knowing full well that the BCD was supposed to be a mandatory term in order to justify a BCD, or third, rejected the plea, had the parties go back and renegotiate, add in more facts to justify a bad conduct discharge. That's just not what happened here.
Counsel, what is the relevance of the provision that if the sentence wasn't upheld, that there would be a waiver of the OTH discharge? This is something new that back before that there could be an agreement on a minimum sentence, there were always provisions saying if the findings aren't affirmed, then maybe the plea agreement goes away. But this is something new that we've seen now where if the minimum sentence isn't affirmed, then something else happens. What is What do we make of that in assessing what the court did here? I mean, is it relevant at all? I mean, one argument might be, look, the government can always – they could have just put in not that you get an OTH, but that would just go to trial again, and you might get a BCD, or you might get convicted of the charges that we dismissed.
Well, Your Honor, the difference there would be that would require a breaching of the plea agreement by Armin Arroyo, which she did not do. And even if the judge didn't judge at BCD, that was an alternate term for the judge not adjudging a BCD, which, again, would not be Armin Arroyo breaching the contract. So
is it a breach of the contract to argue that the BCD is excessive after you argued that it wasn't excessive at trial?
No, Your Honor, because arguing in plea negotiations is one thing, but CCAs have a congressionally mandated duty to do an independent look at the sentence. That is not a secondary bite of the apple. That's an independent mandated review. Even if Armin Arroyo hadn't raised sentence severity, the CCA would have been required to conduct it.
Major Bruja, I hear what you're saying. But I'm curious how the statutory provisions in the code dealing with plea agreements, specifically, I think is the very last provision dealing with the binding effect. I think it's in Article 53A now. Once upon a time it was somewhere else, but I don't know. But it deals with the binding effect on the parties of the plea agreement. How does that kind of play into all of this? What the accused and the government agreed to here, what the military judge found and decided, and what the CCA, in your view, should be doing. Should the CCA be disregarding? Should they ignore that provision of the code dealing with plea agreements and the binding effect of those agreements?
If that was the issue before them and they were considering that, then it would be proper for them to discuss it. But the issue here was sentence appropriateness, which is the same area in which they're doing this analysis under sentence severity in their opinion. I apologize, Chief Judge Olson. I see my time has elapsed. May I finish answering?
Let me first see if there are any other questions. Seeing none, did you want to briefly conclude?
Yes, Your Honor. It's just different. If the issue was the contract and the terms of the contract and whether it could be enforced, et cetera, then that may be appropriate factors to consider. But here we're only talking about Article 66(d)(1) and the CCA's requirement to conduct sentence severity.
Right. But what if they conduct their review and they determine that the sentence, whatever it is, and it happens that it's within the range agreed to?
Well, that's
by the parties, which is what happened here.
I apologize. Yes, Your Honor. And that's happened before. In Carr, the Navy Marine Court found that the BCD was inappropriately severe given the extenuating circumstances, and they set it aside. Contrary to that, Williams, the next Navy Marine case referencing Carr, also argued that the punitive discharge was inappropriately severe, but the Navy Marine CCA found that it wasn't because they didn't find sufficient prejudice, i.e., the punitive discharge wasn't inappropriately severe. So they're still coming back to whether a leg touch, a bad conduct discharge, is inappropriately severe for a leg touch. And in this case, it is.
Did you have any further questions?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Major Bruja. Captain Lee.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Kate Lee, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Every accused sentence must be put in context, and the CCAs do this by considering the entire record. And that's why this court should affirm. Any other result would give appellant an unjust windfall, while also giving accused service members everywhere a green light to negotiate pleas full of promises they don't intend to keep. An unwary trap for trial counsel, if you will. And that will lead to a chilling effect on plea negotiations to the detriment of everyone involved. And, Your Honors, I want to start by addressing some of the questions this court had for the appellant. Your Honor, you asked, can appellant still prevail if the CCA was just considering the punitive exposure? And the answer is no, Your Honor, because the CCA really was just recognizing that appellant was engaged in risk management, because that is what...
Where is that in the record?
Your Honor, in the CCA's opinion, when they're discussing the plea agreement. The plea agreement, of course, is part of the record itself, as is the military judge's colloquy with an accused.
But where in the record is it? What was going through the mind of the accused in terms of their weighing of their punitive exposure? It could be a situation where an accused is thinking, oh, thank God, because they have such great evidence, I absolutely would have been convicted, as compared to an accused who's saying, these are nonsense charges. I wasn't facing any punitive exposure there because they were never going to be able to get through the door here. Where is this in the record that we know what was in the mind of the accused in terms of calculating the BCD as compared to the punitive exposure?
We can't see into the mind of the accused, but I think your question brings up a good point about why the CCAs must consider the entire record. Because if you look at the record as a whole, there is, of course, the pretrial process where appellant and her counsel went through the Article 32 hearing, where preliminary hearing officer found that there was probable cause. Appellant was aware that her counsel litigated several motions in an attempt to suppress incriminating government evidence and lost some of those motions. And the record also reflects that on the day that trial, the litigated trial of the sex offenses was supposed to begin, appellant approached the government with an offer to plead, and they took a 2-day recess in order to work this out. So looking at the record as a whole, I think that tells the CCA and this court that appellant made some decisions, whether or not she was thinking specifically about punitive exposure or just making decisions about the risk she was willing to assume. She traded the possibility that she faced really three outcomes in this case. The possibility that she would litigate and potentially be convicted of and sentenced for sex offenses, the possibility that she would litigate and walk away acquitted of the sex offenses, or the possibility that she could plead and walk away definitely not convicted of a sex offense, and in exchange she agreed to this bad conduct discharge and other punishment. And she chose the third option, presumably because that was the most palatable to her, because that is what plea bargaining is all about, Your Honors. It is risk management, and it's all about competing interests on both sides.
In your brief, you expressed concerns about incentivizing the accused and defense counsel to play games. If we were to rule in your favor, wouldn't we be incentivizing the government to come up with bogus charges and they say, oh, we'll dismiss these, don't worry about it, knowing that then the CCA is going to consider the punitive exposure of what were bogus charges?
Not at all, Your Honor, because, of course, the prosecution we have an ethical duty to bring only those charges that have merit, and in order to prevent, you know, a single trial counsel from being the decision maker, we have processes in place, such as a preliminary hearing officer that goes through the charges and determines whether or not there's probable cause. And so ruling in our favor would not incentivize the government to bring bogus charges. It really just affirms that plea bargaining is all about trade-offs, Your Honor. And if the government, if this court were to rule against the government, that would disincentivize us from engaging in these plea negotiations, which, as I mentioned, would be to the detriment of everyone involved. The accused would, if the government is less interested in bargaining, the accused would lose whatever little control he or she has over the outcome of his case and or her punitive exposure. The victim would be forced to choose between being re-victimized by the trial process or potentially just walking away, not seeing justice done. And society as a whole would suffer because offenders that may have been held accountable and punished and rehabilitated through a plea process may walk free and learn nothing from that experience.
And so, now, is there a distinction to be drawn between sentence appropriateness for the offense to which the accused is pleading guilty as compared to sentence appropriateness for the case involving the accused? And if there is a distinction, and it seems to be that that's the distinction that's being drawn here, why is your position that a CCA would be looking at in the course of their sentence appropriateness determination, whether that sentence is appropriate considering the entire case rather than just the charge?
Your Honor, the government, we're definitely not suggesting that the sentence is appropriate because of all this other misconduct that was, of course, dismissed. What we're saying is, as you mentioned, it would be weird to put blinders on the CCA. And so to the extent that the CCA's discussion is about the context in which an appellant agreed to a specific sentence, which is exactly what happened in this case, that's why it's appropriate to consider this, the fact that there are these, that appellant did get a benefit. In some ways, Your Honor, the CCA's discussion of these dismissed specifications is almost an explanation of why that particular agreement to a bad conduct discharge is not against public policy. The CCA is effectively recognizing this is not the government railroading the accused by any means. She got something out of it in return, and that's why this plea, this particular provision where she's agreeing to a bad conduct discharge for an assault consummated by battery, that's why it wouldn't raise questions in the eyes of the public about the fairness of the process, because it is, again, about trade-offs where the accused interest in whether one accused may want to accept a punitive discharge in exchange for less jail time, while another accused may consider jail time more palatable than a punitive discharge. And so it really comes down to the individualized consideration of a particular case in a particular sentence, which is really why that context that a plea agreement provides is crucial when a CCA is conducting its sentence appropriateness review.
So in the course of your parade of horribles that would happen if we were to rule in favor of the accused here, the appellant here, would those concerns be addressed if there was an understanding going forward that trial counsel and the accused can come to a determination where, as part of that plea agreement, it is specifically acknowledged that the accused has factored in the fact that he or she faced a punitive exposure in light of these other charges? Then we're not wondering what was going through the mind, or the CCA would not be wondering what was going through the mind of the accused. It is right there in the record. It's something that they can point to.
Your Honor,
would that approach address your concerns about how this would damage plea negotiations going forward?
Your Honor, while I think that would certainly, of course, the more that a CCA, a reviewing authority, can point to, the better, I don't think that necessarily negates the concern that if this court rules, otherwise rules in appellant's favor, that it would give appellants carte blanche to challenge a sentence that they've agreed to as part of a plea agreement. Even if they have this provision that says, I considered my punitive exposure, that doesn't say, well, I also concede that my sentence is appropriate. And so that leaves the door open for them to come up on appeal and say, I know I agreed to this, but actually I don't really agree to it anymore. And that, I think, is the sort of trap for unwary trial counsel that Your Honor mentioned, is that if the government is entering into these plea agreements with the understanding that it's the government, for the government, the benefit is in, to some degree, the punishment, because that's accountability for the accused and tangible justice for the victim. But if that punishment can just be can be set aside on appeal because the CCA cannot consider the entire context, I think the government would have very little incentive to engage in plea bargaining, which would be a problem because it is such a large part of our justice process.
Do you read the lower court's opinion as suggesting that as long as the accused agreed to the sentence and trial counsel argued for it and they got a benefit, that marks the end of the CCA's review? I mean, suppose this had been a dishonorable discharge and a year in prison. Would the CCA have just upheld that?
Not at all. That's not how we read the lower court's opinion, Your Honor. I think the lower court, that is one of the fact that the appellant agreed to, negotiated for a bad conduct discharge, agreed to it, expressly asked that her counsel argue for it, is one of the things the CCA considered when it was putting the sentence into context. But it also, I would note, considered the first thing it noted in its analysis were the aggravating factors, the fact that she assaulted a fellow airman, a junior airman, in the presence of her peers and subordinates, and the fact that she was a senior airman. She promoted to 6 months She promoted senior airman and assaulted this junior airman 6 months later. So the CCA noted this aggravating evidence and then noted specifically the lack of extenuating evidence before also mentioning, by the way, she also agreed to this bad conduct discharge as part of a negotiated plea. So it was by no means the beginning and end of their analysis. It was one of the things that they weighed, which was entirely proper because of their mandate that they affirm on the basis of the entire record.
But as part of the agreement, we don't know whether the accused tapped her on the ankle or grasped her on the upper thigh. And I don't know where trial counsel was here in terms of hammering out this agreement, but that seems pretty curious.
Well, Your Honor, I think one thing to remember about the, you know, stipulation of fact and the plea agreement itself is that both parties will have to sign it. And so to the extent the stipulation of fact, you know, of course we would have loved if there was more in the stipulation of fact, but there's, of course, only so much that an appellant or an accused is willing to agree to. So I think that's something we have to keep in mind when we're looking at what the trial operators...
But there's supposed to be a meeting of the minds in terms of a contract. You're saying, don't... We have to understand that they're not going to put these things in there, and we're going to grant the CCA all this authority to start looking at other things even further outside the agreement. Doesn't that seem to be intention?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because of the stipulation, it contained the elements, it contained the facts that met the elements of the offense, and the...
Granted, but when it comes to a sentence appropriate review, one would think that conceding the point you make about senior airmen in front of others, that a tapping on an ankle is very, very different than the grasping in the upper thigh area of another airman.
Well, Your Honor...
And it's not even there. It's not even addressed.
Appellant, in this case, touched leg, which, you know, when you call it just a leg touch, it may seem... It seems like less than it is. But what we should really do is put it in context and remember that appellant pled to an assault consummated by battery. Whether she touched her arm or her leg, she touched her leg, and that is still a violation of that junior airman's bodily autonomy. She didn't have permission to do
granted
so.
Granted on all that, my only point is you're saying to this court, you have to understand that there are instances here because there's only so much that an airman would agree to here. But then, at the same time, you're saying, but we should get into the mind of the airman in terms of her reasoning of this is why I was willing to accept this because of my punitive exposure and so forth. It just seems to be those two positions seem to be in tension with one another.
I see what you're saying, Your Honor. I think the stipulation and how it's used is one thing, and the stipulation is, of course, supplemented by the government's other evidence of her of appellant service data, her and then the victim impact statement and all of that. That's one thing, but whether appellant, what might have been going on in her mind, whether she was trying to limit her punitive exposure or, you know, mitigate her risk in terms of what she faced if she litigated the case, that's a separate thing that the CCA weighed in assessing the fact that she agreed to a bad conduct discharge. So the bad conduct discharge is justified by the facts, of course, and the CCA's analysis is essentially saying we find that the bad conduct discharge is justified by these aggravating facts. There are no extenuating facts that suggest we should downgrade it in some way. And because she also agreed to it for presumably these reasons, that suggests to us that it's a reasonable indication of its probable fairness to her. And so that's how I think those two, the stipulation and what the appellant might have been thinking serve sort of two separate purposes, Your Honor. Barring any further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Any further questions? Please do.
Your Honor, the CCAs can and should consider how a plea agreement may have affected the sentence. The Air Force Court properly did so, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, Captain Lee. Major Bruja.
Sir, I just wanted just to remind the Chief that Major Lee has been promoted since filing the brief.
Since filing the brief, promoted. I should have looked up here. Congratulations on your promotion.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, the government essentially concedes. They said, quote, a leg touch seems less than it is. A leg touch is not appropriate. A bad conduct discharge is not an appropriate sentence for a leg touch. Because as they conceded, a leg touch seems less than what the sentence is that she received. A lifelong stigma that impacts her ability to get jobs, her financial abilities, her position in society. A leg touch with no other aggravating factors is not appropriate.
I think we were saying the same. Can we consider that? I mean, if the CCA had just said affirmed, and you came up and said it's too severe, we would just have to say that we can't address that.
Understood, Your Honor. But this court will also decide whether there's prejudice. In this case, I guess based on this court's position in Swisher, you can just remand regardless of prejudice if the court erred. But I'm only bringing up that the leg touch does not justify a bad conduct discharge because it shows the prejudice in the CCA's analysis. So this court doesn't have to decide whether a bad conduct discharge is inappropriately severe. Aaron Arroyo asked this court to remand for the CCA to conduct that appropriate analysis, which it did not do in this case. Judge Sparks, I wanted to come back to your question about Article 53AE about binding contracts. It does state that it's binding to the parties to include the convening authority and the senior trial counsel, but it says nothing about being binding to the CCAs. And we must read statutes in conjunction with the other statutes together. And that, paired with Article 56 and Article 66D1, shows that appellants should be sentenced first for the offense that they're convicted of, and the CCA should conduct sentence appropriateness review based on that. And this court has stated in Snellian
that. Let me ask you, though, on the same point. So are you saying, and I'm asking genuinely, that notwithstanding what the parties agreed to, and notwithstanding what the military judge holds or rules as the sentence, that the CCA can simply ignore all that in its pursuit to find out how severe the sentence is or how appropriate it is? I'm not challenging you, but I'm just wondering, is that the position?
No, Your Honor, it's not that the CCA ignores it all. The CCA can consider the floor and the ceiling of the plea agreement and the fact that the appellant agreed to a specific term as one factor of probable fairness to her. But the CCAs are supposed to conduct an independent de novo review.
And in this case, you have the additional element of the accused and his counsel asking for a bad conduct discharge, right?
Yes, one factor, Your Honor, but still the CCAs
have... Well, that's a pretty big one, though, isn't it?
It is a factor that they've asked for it, yes, Your Honor, but they are not...
Suggesting that it seems to me that the parties, including the accused, thought that was a reasonable request to make of the military judge.
There have been cases where, such as Carr, where the parties do determine a BCD or a punitive discharge is appropriate, but the CCA does their independent review and finds that it's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. Because while the parties may have understood a lot of other factors in their minds, in the meeting of their minds, mm-hmm. it still has to be before the military judge to justify a bad conduct discharge. And the CCAs in Article 66D also must do a de novo look at the sentence. Mm-hmm. Because as this court stated in Beyer, it's not just about sentence severity. It's also about whether there's a fair and just punishment for every accused. And here, based on the facts that the CCA, Your Honor, may...
Please proceed.
Based on the facts presented to the CCA, a bad conduct discharge is not justified by the leg touch with no other aggravating factors and with 20 exhibits from the defense side, character letters, a letter from her therapist showing rehab potential, the fact that she was selected senior airman below the zone above her peers, there was no prior disciplinary or misconduct.
Yeah, I understand the point. I won't belabor it.
Any further questions? Did you want to briefly conclude?
Yes, Your Honor. Absent this court providing guidance, mischief will result without crisp, clear guidance. And in this case, this court can give a narrow holding, which is that CCAs cannot consider dismissed specifications specifically in its sentence severity review.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks both Major Bruja and Major Lee. And the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.